we're back. And since you were last with us, so much has happened. We have news that Team Sky is, of course, set to become Team Ineos. And I'm sure you've read all about that, so we won't dwell on it too much here. More to come from that in the future, I'm sure, as we get nearer to the Tour de Yorkshire, where Ineos Official is set to launch. Elsewhere, the pro racing calendar continues to pick up pace, and it was actually Team Sky Riders who impressed in Paris-Nice, which is going back a week or so now. Egan Bernal proving what a phenomenal talent he is by handling everything the hugely entertaining race threw at him, alongside equally impressive teammates Luke Rowe and Kwiatkowski. It's going to be very interesting to see how Bernal gets on at the Giro. That race is shaping up to be a cracker, given that it's got such a solid field with no real clear-cut standout favourite at the moment. Now, aside from stage racing, we also witnessed the 110th edition of Milan-San Remo last week, famously known as the easiest race to finish, but the hardest race to stay awake for. And with that said, the winner deserves huge congratulations, obviously. Alaphilippe seemingly going from strength to strength and looking immensely strong in the finish against fierce, big-name competition. You wonder what Sagan was doing in the last kilometre of that race, and you think he might still be suffering from a little bit of the illness that plagued him in Tirreno the week before, or maybe he just screwed up that finale tactically. But that takes nothing away from Alaphilippe, and he, like Bernal, is shaping up to have quite the career. But mentioning San Remo does bring us into this.
Run! Go! Get to the chopper!
Chopper of the week.
Yep, it's that time again. And this week, I want to nominate the motorbike rider in front of Nicolò Bonifazio as he descended the Cipressa during last Sunday's race. Firstly, we have to say what an incredible show of skill it was from Bonifazio. I had my jaw on the floor witnessing him hammer that downhill so hard. He hit 85k an hour on what's a very technical, twisty descent, and he admitted after the race that he touched the brakes only two or three times on the solo attack. Now, the Direct Energy rider described a Cipressa as his gym or his office in the post-race interviews, and his local knowledge clearly showed, and he absolutely tore down that climb. But as he did so, as is often the case, we're left with the case of the motorbikes impeding the riders in big stages. So whilst the driver will remain unnamed, we've got to ask in future they just get out of the way, and until then, that particular driver is awarded the chopper of the week. So now that's out of the way, we can jump into today's episode. For this week, we have a chat with Mr. Will Girling. Now, Will is a performance nutritionist who has worked with a variety of world-class athletes. And in this episode, we look to debunk a few popular myths that linger in the world of cycling. You can find more about Will and what he does at willgirling.com, and you can catch him on Instagram at willgirling. Now, in this chat with Will, we learn about his background and how he came into the sport, including detail on an absolutely horrendous injury that he suffered in a crash last year. We move on to discuss an age-old classic in cycling circles, the Fasted Ride, including an exploration of how Froome managed his weight on the way to winning last year's Giro d'Italia. We talk about vegans and vegetarians of the world, what they need to be careful of, in particular when following these diets. We look at supplements, vitamins, which are important, which aren't important for endurance athletes, including an interesting one that you may not have heard about in the context of cycling. Will goes into the power of nitrates for cyclists and how you can get them inside you. And finally, we learn about how to embrace the power of placebo. And then on top of that, Will's one super cheap, super undervalued, super duper food, that you need to start getting more of. So here it is, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you enjoy. It is our episode with Will Girling.
Thanks so much for coming on and finding the time. This one's been a bit of a slow burner, but we've finally made it.
We got there in the end, didn't we?
Yeah, so it's good to have you. It's good to have you. So let's jump straight in the interest of time, because you know you're very busy. So first question that we ask all of our guests is just to give a bit of context as to who you are, etc. It'd be good if you could briefly introduce yourself, who you are, what you do, and maybe how you came to be where you are today.
Sure, yeah. So I'm William Girling. I'm a performance nutritionist. I've worked with OnePro Cycling for two seasons. I worked with Trek Drops for a season. I currently work with a couple of World Tour riders, one of which is for CCC. And I've worked with a variety of athletes, to Ironman Kona winners, heavyweight boxers, Indonesia rugby, Paralympics, Team GB, Invictus Games. So quite an array of athletes, really. And how I got into it, I guess I got into it through being a PT and realizing nutrition was something that I wanted to do because it interested me the most and seemed to be what people struggled with the most. And through there, I did my master's degree and my degree in postgrad qualifications, and currently applying to do my PhD in it. So
nice.
Pretty much the journey.
Yeah, and I think what really made me want to get you on the pod was something you've just mentioned there, in that nutrition seems like one of these things that you, for every one side of the coin, you'll get an equal number of people to argue the flip side of that coin. And I think it can be difficult as a layperson to kind of see the wood through the trees and see what's reality and what's just, you know, chat.
Yeah, completely.
So I thought we'd use this time to maybe try and debunk, sort of tackle some of those common myths that we hear, because cycling is, I think, really bad for that. I mean, all sport obviously gets it, but I think cycling is pretty terrible for it.
Yeah.
Just before we go into that, though, actually, you personally, you've got quite an interesting kind of entry into the world of cycling, at least in your own riding, in that you were more of a power lifter and a big heavy weights lifting guy before getting into cycling, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I did strongman. I competed in strongman, and I power lifted as well. So, you know, I was one of those. I used to weigh in at about 115, 116 kilos, and used to lift and run with really big heavy things. But I made, as I started working, you know, from a nutrition perspective with OnePro in particular, I started riding more, and I steadily just progressed more into doing riding, and then pretty much kind of, I guess, switched my sport a little bit, but I still lift even now, but do both.
Mm-hmm. And you had a pretty gnarly crash a few months back.
So I
heard about in another podcast.
That's right, yeah. I was hit by a lorry, and I can't remember if I said it in that podcast, but I did actually die, and was, you know, brought back, I guess. I broke pretty much everything in my body, but
is a first for this podcast. Back from the dead, we're speaking to undead guest.
Yeah,
it's mental. You listed off the injuries that you got off the back of that crash.
It
just sounds horrific. Was this in the UK?
Yeah, it was in the UK. It was in Hertfordshire. Like my normal riding route out from where I live in North London, and collided with this lorry, and I mean, I don't even remember it happening, but that's what happened, and it's always the way, but it's definitely been tough kind of coming back from that, because I was at the fittest I'd ever been. I was starting to take on, I wanted to break a world record, and I was training, meticulously for that, and I'd been on several training camps. I was, I started competing in TT. I got a 1 hour FTP of like 385 watts. I became quite a bit of an animal on the bike, and then obviously, it's very quickly shut down.
Man, that's savage. What happened with the driver? Was there any communication with him or
just
her?
because there was only us two on the road and no witnesses or anything like this, and I can't remember anything. Nothing has really happened from it, and had some lawyers look into it, whatever, and that because there's literally no evidence at all. And for the most case, most lorries don't even see the rider either. It's pretty much, nothing really to know in that case, which is no biggie. I think, obviously with these kind of things, I'm not bothered about getting money from it or anything. I think for me, it's about, I need to 5-6 months on, which is 6 months now, accepting that something like that has happened to me, and accepting that certain things about me physically will never be the same. And also, all that time and effort and years I've put into, fine tuning myself as an athlete, I lost a lot of that, pretty much. And I lost everything that I worked for the bike. I'm terrible, awful on the bike now.
Yeah, well, props for coming back into it. I mean, that in itself takes a lot. And you're looking to go back and tackle the kind of unfinished business that you set out to do in the first place. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, initially, I think I said I was going to go for it in 2020, spend this year rebuilding. But I think it's going to take a bit longer. I think it's probably going to be like 2021 when I'm 30, because it's just going to take a lot longer than I thought, get back into it.
That's a good approach. No, props to you for that. All right, cool. So that gives a bit of context and actually I should mention the other podcast that I mentioned was a 10,000 kilometer pod, and you go into that side of things in your own personal cycling into a bit more detail on that. So if you want to hear more of that story, go check those guys out. But actually, I thought for today, we could maybe drill down into some, like I said, some common myths, try and debunk some nutrition and stuff. And let's start with an age-old classic for the cyclist, the fasted ride. So when I talk about fasted riding, what exactly are the performance benefits of riding fasted, if any, aside from kind of losing weight, obviously, by promoting a calorie deficit? Any distinction to be made between riding at different intensities while fasted, i.e. some better than others? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, definitely. I got loads of thoughts on that.
Okay, good.
Even first off, like what you're saying there, so like increased fat oxidation through fasted training is an interesting one, because you do within the session burn more fat because you obviously have low glycogen or stored carbohydrate, so you do utilize fat at a higher rate. But if you take two equal days and you on both days you did exactly the same ride and burnt exactly the same amount of calories, and you ate exactly the same amount of calories, so in turn you had the same deficit exactly in both days, but one was fasted and one was fed, it's physiologically impossible to suggest that you'd burn more fat in the other if the overall deficit in 24 hours is identical. Mm-hmm. Because you can't lose more of something that isn't available to lose because the deficit is the same. So over 24 hours, the amount of fat lost would be identical between both a fed and a fasted ride. So okay. Even from a fat oxidation point of view, it's not the literature isn't necessarily there to suggest that, over that 24-hour period, that if the scenarios are the same, you're actually getting a greater benefit.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. And is this, so like, for instance, this is one thing that comes out if you read, any of the rubbish that you see in like Cycling Weekly or anything like that comes up every kind of 2 months. They'll just sling up an article on riding fasted, you know, as part of their like kind of merry-go-round of stuff that they repeat every couple of weeks. Yeah. And like one thing that I saw that was interesting was when Froome won the Giro last year, a lot of the data that came out when they published the data was focused on his diet and focused on how across the course of that race last year, he actually aimed to lose weight, which in itself is like a bit of a mindfuck and kind of incredible. But a lot of the mainstream media pounced on that and focused on the idea of him having like a boiled egg for breakfast and not a lot else, or going out and then doing like a big 200 kilometer stage of only eating an avocado. So the science behind that is purely based on him just not eating. It's not necessarily that it's not the intention of the ride for him to ride without carbohydrate, or is there more to it? Am I missing the point?
I'm pretty sure in the data that it released, they did release some of his days eating, and like he was still having monstrous calories like each day. And I would feel like he wouldn't be able to get, maybe certain stages they could pick and choose where he did a fasted ride, but I'd be hard pressed to say that he did one. Did he do a fasted ride during the Giro?
I feel maybe I've got it a little bit mixed up, but there's a big BBC article which I can maybe put in the link on this pod that maybe the BBC twisted that and they were mixing his training rides and stuff rather than stuff from the race. But I remember a big thing about that, about post him winning that, a lot was made about him riding at least training rides, whether or not in the race, on that kind of fuel, and saying how that's how he got down to the weight and that's basically how he won the race, which obviously there's way more to it than that. So
definitely, like I've been, you know, I've been lectured and spoken personally with Team Sky's nutritionist James Morton on several occasions, and other than the guy obviously being incredibly good at what he does, I know he probably wouldn't do any fasted rides with him in the race at all. Like they wouldn't get through it, like that kind of racing with it. But you know, it was great to see strategically how they reduced, you know, his weight over the race to allow him to achieve, you know, what he did on that stage, and you know, make
breakaway. I thought that was such a, like when they laid it out and the way they did, I thought it was incredible, because that felt like such a, obviously a calculated risk, but that feels like such a risk given that he's kind of on a knife edge there in terms of his performance just falling off a cliff. Because I think if we look at that, another athlete who was absolutely storming for most of that race in Yates, and then I think the rumors about why he fell off so hard and he lost that just huge amounts of time in that one stage was because his fueling strategy just kind of fell off a cliff.
Yeah.
Just to show how it's so important, and for them to gamble in such a way with that was amazing. I also liked in that article, they picked out, you know, everything he was eating, and one of the things that made me laugh was like his post ride recovery shake was something like 2,300 calories, which was like mental. I'd love to see what they put in that shit.
I've got some of his information up here, like, you know, some of the days how they, you know, they compare, like stage 11, he took on 78 grams of carbohydrate, 28 grams of protein, 11 grams of fat before the race, which is 500 calories. I mean, looking at that meal, it's pretty much bang on what he needs to be having from a general performance point of view. He's not going to be setting any records in that race, but that's about 1.1, 1.2 grams per kilogram of body weight of carbohydrate, which should replenish his liver glycogen stores, which will help him maintain blood glucose levels through the race. And then it'll obviously fuel during the race enough to still elicit a deficit afterwards. And I mean, with teams like that, you know, £21 million budget, they've got a chef on hand, you know, James Morton will be there, and they'll look at that data immediately afterwards, and they'll be on how much he needs to eat right after that race straight away.
Yeah.
And they'll be making plans on the fly like that, because they've got enough people to do it, you know, but teams with less budget probably aren't going to be as likely. To do that.
And I think that was more maybe linked to my initial point in that it just seems like, from my perspective, but this probably just come a greedy pig, in that 500 calories before a stage of that nature on such a prestigious race where the intensity is going to be so high. Like, I would eat more than 500 calories for breakfast before my like 40 mile like chop round the Surrey Hills, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely like a big thing in like a lot of the cyclists I work with, in a lot of overfueling, like, you know, the amount we actually need to facilitate the effort and the what we're going to do isn't huge. You know, there are amounts that we know will work, but it depends on what you're going to do as well. So, I mean, you compare that to his stage 19, obviously, that he won.
Yeah.
His breakfast was 189 grams of carbs, 31 grams of protein and 32 grams of fat, which is, you know, 1,000-calorie meal for the pre-race.
That's more like it.
Yeah, and that'll be part of a carb load, as you know, resaturating his muscle with loads of glycogen, so he's ready to perform a ridiculous effort, which is, you know, what he did. So, you know, and that's going up to the upper limits of what is recommended for that kind of meal before a big effort, which is, you know, around 2.4, 2.5 grams per kilogram of body weight.
So, I mean, in terms of macronutrients, just going back a step on that, is it just a case of, say, for instance, for endurance sports, you mentioned the, was it 1.2 grams of carb per kilo of body weight? Kind of hard and fast rule like that. Do those rules stick to every individual, or will a team like Team Sky be tailoring their approach depending on the makeup of that rider or that person? So do some people adapt and need more carbs, or is it just a case of this is the amount per how heavy you are?
No, yeah, so that's a great question. So the amount per kilo, obviously, the amount that the person is given will depend on the goal at hand. So the ranges of how much grams of carbohydrate to have for like replenishment is going to be anywhere between like 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight all the way up to that kind of 2.4, 2.5 grams. So there's a large reference range there of how much to have for a given meal for an individual, all related obviously to their body weight, but it will depend on what stage the race is or what you're going out planning to do. Is there a body composition based goal, and how that all fits in? Because you know, a great example is actually using stage racing in this. You know, if a rider wakes up light in the morning, that means that they've under replenished. They're either dehydrated, and or they're low on glycogen, which means that the amount they would eat before that race would be greater depending on what they're required to do on that race. Obviously, each rider has their own role of what they need to do. But, you know, how much you need to have for what you're doing will always be kind of referred back to in that. And I think, you know, if you're a lot of riders and a lot of general everyday people out there that do like to ride their bike will have some form of body composition based goal. So ultimately over the week, them having a calorie deficit is something that's needed. But this kind of ties in back nicely with your other point about, you know, fasted riding, but also, you know, everyone's goal of you know, achieving better body composition, how to periodize their nutrition, because periodizing their nutrition is the main approach. And this is something that I practice and do with every athlete and person that I work with. And when you look at fasted rides, what we mainly see now is that you see a heightened response to the exercise activity. So neurotransmitters and enzymes and proteins react greater to that given stimulus in a low glycogen state, in specific in endurance based activity. And this sees an increase in how we adapt to it by creating more mitochondria. So mitochondria is the aerobic cell that we have. And so doing fasted rides seems to increase the rate at which we produce those cells. But compared to like if you did it fed with carbohydrate. So the hypothesis is that obviously if you can create more mitochondria, you get fitter quicker for the same given exercise.
Okay, I get you. Yeah, interesting. So that's something you would posit as a benefit. Is that something that you, so in terms of if you're working with athletes and with riders, that is something that you include in their programs?
Definitely, right? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you need to pick and choose when you use them. Definitely, because fasted riding increases cortisol production. If that person's already feeling under the weather or is particularly stressed or is doing a big block or at the end of a big block, the potential risk for infection is greater.
Okay.
So like an upper respiratory tract infection, say, you know, a cold or something like this, it is greater. So I wouldn't use it then. It's also important to look at the purpose of the ride. What are you trying to achieve in that specific ride? Are you going out and doing, you know, zone 3 tempo or, you know, zone 4 hill repeats or, you know, stuff like this? Then if your ride has intensity in it, that's a performance-based ride. And I would say that you don't want to do that fasted. You're defeating the point of the ride. The ride is to do those efforts hard and do them well. Whereas if you're going out and doing a zone 2 ride for 4 hours or something, 3 or 4 hours, and you're sticking in zone 2, that's a perfect ride to, you know, do fasted.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's a good way of putting it.
And I think that's how people need to think about their weeks. You know, if for the most part, you know, the working population, you work 9 to 5, and they're probably going to fit a turbo session in either in the morning or in the evening. And the last thing you want to do is it, you know, you want to maximize that hour, you want to smash out a really intense turbo session. You don't want to be doing that fasted. Like, that's going to be a hard session. And to maintain blood glucose levels, especially upon waking, you need to have carbohydrate. Otherwise, you're going to dip off and you're going to find that the back end of that session really hard. I think fitter riders, like really, you know, high level riders, will manage it, because the higher level rider you are, obviously, the more mitochondria and aerobic cells you have. So your ability to be fitter and to utilize, you know, more fat and so on like this is going to be greater. But for the inefficient rider, the less experienced rider, the, you know, they're not going to be that great at it. And, you know, they need to be fueling for it. And that'd be the same for the faster rides. I think telling a relatively intermediate rider to go out and do 4 hours fasted is still going to be a big ask. You know, so start off with like 2 hours fasted, which you'll definitely get through, and then build upon that. Don't jump out for the big day fasted, because it'll suck.
Yes or no? Did you ever take banned substances to enhance your cycling performance?
Yes.
Yes or no? Was one of those banned substances EPO?
Yes.
Did you ever blood dope or use blood transfusions to enhance your cycling performance?
Yes.
Did you ever use any other banned substances like testosterone, cortisone, or human growth hormone?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, cool.
Yes.
Good advice. So let's switch it up a little bit and talk about something else that crops up all over the internet and on YouTube and on Instagram, and that is veganism. So obviously there's plenty of people that combine a vegan diet with athletic performance without issue. But from your experience, maybe perhaps you've worked with vegan athletes or with vegetarian athletes, is there anything that we should be particularly wary of if on a vegan or a veggie diet? Because obviously there's lots of people that would claim that vegan diets lead to deficiencies in things like protein and vitamins and omega-3, things like that.
Yeah.
Is there anything to that?
Oh, completely. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, even like really well-versed in the literature to show that, you know, there are deficiencies and things and extra requirements for vegans in particular, more so than vegetarians. But it's always important to differentiate between the act, like a normal person who's, you know, just going about their day, and the athlete who's a vegan, because the requirement for an athlete is greater already. You know, And you see in a lot of these programs, like What the Health or whatever, you know, I remember they even made a mention about protein, and we don't need that much protein and things like this. The everyday person only needs 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight of protein. Mm-hmm. And that's not much. That's very, very minor. You know,
what is that for, like, a, say, a 70, 75 kilo guy?
I think not much.
What does it look like in real food terms? Like
60 grams of protein. So, like, if a protein shake was 30 grams,
okay,
like, it's not, you know, 60 grams is nothing.
Yeah.
Like, that's typically something you'd get from just eating three meals a day, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But when you compare that to the athlete, you should be having between like 1.6 and 2.4. And if they're trying to gain muscle mass, this isn't specifically relating to cycling, because I doubt most riders would do this, but, you know, 3.4 grams, which is, you know, a huge amount,
yeah,
of protein to have. But you need those requirements to recover and to create adaptation to exercise, because you do only adapt to exercise through protein. That is the main driver of adaptation from a physiological point of view, from recovery. Obviously, you create stimulus through doing exercise, and then to allow that stimulus to be carried over to the production of cell and muscle mass to deal with that, you need the protein there to do that.
Yeah, and yeah, that's a good point. Because obviously that's something I think has come up before in this pod, obviously, and I think some people can easily forget that it's not the exercise itself, like you said. It's only when in recovery, when you're not exercising, do you make those fitness gains. And obviously that's a thing that lots of people, probably myself included, need to remember when they're just going out and smashing sessions and like overtraining and getting injured and stuff. Only when you start paring it back and you have those off days do you make those adaptions. But I haven't actually never made the link by taking it a step further in the way you've just said. And it's more than that. It's protein itself. It's that building block, which allows the progression.
Yeah,
that's an interesting way of putting it. But so you don't think that it would be, so let's try and, if we're keeping it specific to cycling, you don't think that you think that would be difficult, say for just an endurance cyclist who's looking to train 4, 5, 6 times a week, that's difficult to achieve with a vegan diet and just by eating beans and
it's harder. It is achievable, but completely achievable. But it definitely requires, I think, too many people choose to become vegan and don't really think about the how hard or how much they need to realistically change to still achieve the things that they need. You know, you look at all the other micronutrients that they need, omega-3, you look at zinc, magnesium, iodine, iron, vitamin B12, all of these are really, you know, important micronutrients that aren't as easily available in a vegan diet, or require us to really think about the food that we're having, because we're all guilty of it. But that is being creatures of habit. And if you're working, once again, 9 to 5 every week, and you do your training sessions also, and go out on your rides on the weekend, very typically you're going to have the same breakfast, you're going to have the same lunch from the area that you work in, you're going to have very similar dinner, because you're rushed for time and you're training, which means that variety of nutrients is reduced, and the consideration given to, I'm not getting certain nutrients because I've already excluded so much food from my diet, needs to be thought about, I think, a little bit greater.
Yeah, so in terms of taking it away from vegans specifically, when we talk, you just mentioned vitamins there and things that vegans especially need to be wary of in terms of being deficient. Are there any vitamins or maybe even supplements that you would proactively recommend to all cyclists? Is there anything that cycling or endurance athletes in particular tend to need more of, or that they may necessarily lack in? And this is the reason I ask this, is because this is an area that, from a personal point of view, irks me a little bit, because it's just such a, it's this area, it's so clouded with just stuff from every angle. There's companies obviously trying to peddle this and that, and it's hard to see what's just rubbish and what's maybe actually has a bit of weight to it.
Completely. I think you can list the amount of things in a handful, really. So if you look at it from a performance enhancing like supplement, it's going to be limited to Whey protein has effectiveness and is proven, but isn't essential by any means. Creatine is the most scientifically proven sports supplement out there, and it has purpose in cycling as well, even with the, you know, the water gain that you get from that. And we can talk about that if you want.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Beta-alanine, which is a lactate buffer improving performance between 1 and 4 minutes, is, you know, well-versed and has enough literature there to say that is, you know, definitely worthwhile. And caffeine.
Phone's ringing.
Yeah, I know. And then, caffeine.
Caffeine, 100%. I'm on that.
And then from a micronutrient point of view that you were mentioning, the main ones I'd always say is vitamin D3 during the winter months.
Yeah.
Because we can't actually get it, especially in this country, from sunlight, because the angle of the earth changes. So even if it is a sunny day, we don't get the UV rays that we need to produce vitamin D3. And that helps with bone health and immunity. So, which is obviously really important in winter. And the other thing might be iron. It's very, very common for endurance athletes to be low in iron.
Okay. And how would I, so would you recommend taking iron just as a precaution, or is there any way of me easily testing whether I was potentially deficient in that or needed extra?
Yeah, you can very easily just go to your doctors and request, say that you're, you know, a very active cyclist doing a lot of endurance based exercise and feeling quite tired and fatigued. I'd like to see if I can get my iron levels checked. They shouldn't really say no to that, especially if you give good reasoning for it. And obviously you get that for free, and that'll check your iron levels. Typically a 4 to 6 week course of iron shouldn't do any harm, but I would check with your doctor first.
Okay, cool. We should caveat all of this.
Yeah.
Anything that comes out of my mouth, I'm not a doctor, so obviously consult your GP if you're going to go and do anything radical and silly. So taking it back a little step, you mentioned a couple of interesting little nuggets. One of them was, so beta-alanine, am I saying that right?
Yeah, beta-alanine.
How would that be, what does that look like? How would that be consumed, and how would you kind of integrate it into training?
Yeah, it's a powder or a tablet typically, very similar to most supplements. And you'd load that for 4 to 6 weeks, and then you're going on to a maintenance phase after that. And essentially what that does is it allows you to, it buffer hydrogen ions, which build up within the muscle. And when they build up too much, you get that typical burning sensation, which is acidosis. And all this allows you to do is create more carnosine in the muscle, which then helps further buffer those hydrogen ions and allows you to push a little bit harder for a little bit longer.
Okay. So that you go through that build phase, and then you mentioned there's a maintenance phase. How long would the effects of that last, or am I able to then take that forevermore, or is there like a period at which
forevermore, really? So there's nothing to say that you should stop having it. Once you've loaded, there's a half-life of 10 weeks, so you could stop after 6 weeks and it will carry on working for another 10 weeks. So if that's what you wanted to do, or obviously you could, because it's a 6 week load, which is quite a long time, I'd just say keep taking it, to be honest. It depends how performance orientated you are, but definitely that 1 to 4 minute range is a pretty important zone. You know, that's looking at zone 4 efforts, really, zone 4, zone 5 efforts. So it'll improve those.
Is that something you with your time at OnePro, is that something you would recommend it to every rider, or is it a case of preference, or does it relate to the training plans? Or
it was a recommendation for every rider, for sure. You know, I recommend that to pretty much all my endurance based athletes, but it's always about cost as well. You know, once you've paid for it, you know, everything else, do you have the ability to pay for that on top of it? But I would say that, you know, there's enough to argue that, you know, whether it's a 1% gain or not, you know, not that it is specifically 1%, but like there is a gain to be had there. So if you can have it, I'd take it, especially for a professional. And that's similar for, I guess, moving on to creatine, really.
Yeah, because this is something that I've heard of and been exposed to in more of like a, if you go to the gym and you're lifting things, I'd never actually seen it or heard about it being referenced in a more endurance based context.
Yes.
Talk to us about that.
So creatine improves your 10 second and below power. So it'll improve your peak power. It'll improve your strength. It'll improve your recovery between sets of peak power or efforts like that. It also improves recovery between sessions. It has been shown to help improve lean muscle mass and also drop fat mass over a 12-week period of taking that. When you specifically look at it in relation to cycling, I would do it in two parts of your training year, which would be, one would be your off season when you're doing gym work to help with getting the most out of that small period of time that you are in the off season and doing gym work. Mm-hmm. And the other would be when you're doing a phase of high intensity training. You want to get the most out of those high intensity sessions. So taking on creatine in a 5-day load, so you only need to take it for 5 days at 20 grams a day. It's going to saturate your muscle with creatine. It's going to help with those 10 second efforts. And that will last for about 6 weeks, that half-life, which means that that will last you a whole training block of high intensity training. That water weight will drop off and then you can go back to doing, you know, your competitive race and rides.
Okay, interesting. And I know this might be difficult, but if possible, for an idiot like me, in layman's terms, how exactly is it working to do that? Because you mentioned the effects of it and what it would achieve. What's actually going on once I've taken that creatine and it's in my body?
So that's saturating the muscle again with creatine monohydrate, which helps with the energy system, your ATP creatine phosphate system, which ATP molecules are energy molecules. Mm-hmm. So when we're performing exercise, we have a limited amount of those before we have to start going into reserves and things like this to create more energy. What it allows you to do is create ATP faster in that period of time, mm-hmm. Which means that you can perform, I guess, just, you know, simply as saying better within that time period, by having a greater store of creatine phosphate within the muscle. So it just allows you to make the max out of those 10 seconds. It is specific to that kind of time period. But when you look at, if you're doing lots of maybe training for crits, which a lot of, you know, everyday people are going to do, they're going to do the summer crit series or something like this. Mm-hmm. If you're doing loads of crit efforts, 10 second velocity work, it'll help with also, you know, the first 10 seconds of 25 second crit sprints, things like this. Then you're going to get a lot of return from it.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. It's not something I'd heard before. So
yeah, it's also, you know, you look at crit racing in particular as well. There's no real big climbs. It's all about sprints. It's all about power. I'd take creatine hands down.
Yeah, you look a bit puffy though, so you might be a bit embarrassed when you get to the cafe ride. And you might look as mean as your friends, so you might have to maybe wear a long sleeve top or something if you want that.
I mean, you do get that water weight, yeah. But obviously that depends on the amount of muscle mass you have as well. You know, a 65, 70, 75 kilo rider who has, you know, a lean mass of however much compared to someone like myself who's 100 plus kilos and the amount of muscle mass I have, I gain a lot more weight than you will. Mm. So, and that's why it's always important to kind of relate it back to that goal. What kind of races are you doing? Are you just doing crits? Cool. That's pretty much, you know, a great race to be using creatine for, because there's no long extended climbs. It's all kickers and, you know, short efforts, which is, you know, where creatine is, it's, you know, it's the main driver of that. But you look at road racing, then no, it's, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 hours. You know, extended climbs, maybe not so much in the UK, but it wouldn't be the ideal for that kind of racing.
Yeah, I get you. Okay, cool. So that's vitamins and sups and things like that. Actually, one other thing on that, this is something that's come up fairly recently from my perspective anyway, in the past few months, and that's spirulina. Obviously, spirulina has been around for ages, and but it's specifically in the context of cycling. Spirulina, along with other foods like blueberries, or these foods that are maybe posited to boost our blood and obviously improve our performance accordingly. Is there any truth in that kind of approach, or in people taking spirulina as a supplement, or eating loads of blueberries? I've seen a few people on Instagram and stuff like that. What's going on there? Is that rubbish? Or
I mean, blueberries for what, like currants, like that New Zealand blueberry. I mean, the New Zealand blueberry,
like beetroot. So, like, there was a thing which I don't know if this is true or not, but like, Team Sky used to drink loads of beetroot juice because it was antioxidizing. And blueberries are high in antioxidants.
Yeah, beetroot juice is one. I mean, I've never really used it for antioxidants, but for nitrates, it definitely has been shown to improve performance.
And how does that work then?
That's through something called nitrates, and the conversion of nitrates to nitric oxide within the body, causing vasodilation within the blood vessels, which causes them to expand and widen, which means that you can get more blood through. A really nice stack, obviously, is to do like beta-alanine and nitrates, because then you're getting improved blood flow as well as an increase in your lactic buffering capability. And obviously, if you can get more blood to the muscle, you can reduce the amount of hydrogen ions building up in the muscle, so you can once again perform for longer. So beetroot juice does do that.
Okay,
sure.
Would there be any kind of limit? Could I just go to Tesco later on tonight and then just buy liters of it and sit and drink beetroot juice all night and then wake up a beast tomorrow?
So typically you load it, and for the amateur, you know, the untrained rider, you could typically have 800 milligrams of nitrates, which is, you know, two shots of concentrated beetroot juice about 2 to 4 hours before your race or your effort or whatever. But if you're a more of a seasoned rider, I would probably start loading it and doing about 4 days of 800 milligrams a day in the lead up to the race and on the day.
Okay.
And that's very typical for that. In regards to spirulina, I haven't done too much reading or literature on spirulina apart from one recently, because some guy was using it all the time.
Yeah.
Advocating that it was amazing. And in his book that he's writing, I asked for references for, he only had one reference to spirulina, and I read that paper and it had no effect on performance. So I was like,
that's interesting. Yeah. I wonder who you're talking about.
I shouldn't really name names.
No, don't, if you don't feel the need to. But yeah, this is what I was kind of getting at. I feel like, and I've mentioned this a couple of times now, it's one of these things that someone mentions something's trendy and then another person jumps on the bandwagon and also starts saying, oh yeah, this is great, it's made me so much faster, and then it snowballs.
The placebo effect is truly well known. That's why we use placebos in science against actual trials, because that's to see if just taking something makes you perform better. And, you know, if you say to someone, this will make you really strong, and they start taking it, you know, they'll think they're feeling stronger.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's actually something I was going to mention in reference to protein shakes. Obviously, you mentioned a little bit earlier on, protein is immediately after efforts, protein's proven to help and help recovery, etc., etc. But I do genuinely feel like, in addition to that, there is a massive element, at least whenever I take a protein shake after a hard like turbo session or whatever, there is that element of like, this is kind of healing me, you know, just, you know what I mean? And I feel like, so the next morning when I wake up, I feel like my legs could potentially feel better than they would otherwise, just because of that mental kind of aspect to it and having that ritual of, this is my like recovery drink.
Yeah. I mean,
or maybe I like it because it makes you feel more pro, feel like you're pro when you get stuff is bite. But
mental aspects are important though. That's something I learned a lot in one pro. You know, how a rider feels, it is massively important. If they feel good, they'll ride well. And if you can further increase that through nutritional practice, intervention, and so on, that's your job. whilst they still feel awesome. But if you tell a rider to have something, and even if it's scientifically proven to make them a better rider, but they feel shit on it, then they're not going to ride as well. So, you know, there is something that you can always kind of take from that, but that's me saying it as a scientist who knows, not just spending money on something that's expensive and thinking it works, you know?
Yeah.
And I think spirulina possibly is one of those. I believe it's pretty high in iron. And antioxidants, and there's literature out there for helping antioxidants improving recovery and free radicals with its effect on inflammation. Obviously, a reduction in inflammation and then improves recovery. But there's also, contrary to that, plenty of evidence out there to suggest that obviously when you finish exercising, you get an inflammatory response, which is you adapting to the given stimulus. And through adapting, you then get stronger. But if you take on antioxidants, like a really popular one was taking on vitamin C after training to improve recovery, because you blunt that level of inflammation through taking an intervention, you then reduce your adaption to that exercise. So you don't actually get as fit as quickly.
Yeah, I'm with you. Just take it back a step. Did you say free radicals?
Yeah,
that sounds like a rubbish like 90s Britpop band or something.
What's
a free radical?
Free radicals. So that's what antioxidants deal with within the body.
Okay, what would a free radical look like or do, and how do they form?
Free radicals are typically they're mainly referred to against like cancerous points and things like this. So if you have lots and lots, if you don't have any antioxidants in your diet, which means you avoid vegetables, then the amount of free radicals in the body would be greater, which means that your risk of illness and things will go up, and your amount of inflammation within the body will go up. And obviously, inflammation is directly linked to incidence of illness and an issue within the body.
Yeah, cool. Free radical. I like that. I feel like whoever came up with that initially was having a laugh because it doesn't sound very scientific, but that's good. All right, cool. I'm conscious that you're a very, very busy man and I've been rambling on. There's actually loads more we could talk about. So maybe we could at some stage come back and do like a Mythbuster part two, but let's try and wrap up. But one thing I want to do before we start wrapping it up, we've mentioned, and you've actually said how a few of these things are related to cost, and I've mentioned how lots of these things like spirulina maybe are can be quite expensive, and even though they're espoused as superfoods. But is there anything in your opinion, any foods that that anyone can get their hands on, that you could get down any standard supermarket or shop, that you think get overlooked in favor of these more like fancy and trendy superfoods? There might not be, but is there anything that you can think of, especially for cyclists? Like the one that I've always springs to mind. Obviously, everyone knows about how good oats are for cyclists and for endurance sports, but I genuinely still think they are underappreciated and undervalued just in terms of bang for buck. Like oats are so cheap, and they're, in terms of what they can do when you put them inside you, I think it's incredible. Is there anything like along those lines that you'd maybe recommend that we could get more of without spending loads of money?
Milk.
Yeah. Okay, go on.
Milk is a complete protein source in itself. It has all the essential amino acids. It comes with carbohydrate. You can get it in different grades of fat. The amount of calories that you want for it. Mm-hmm. It's been proven to rehydrate you better than water does after a session. It promotes hypertrophy, or the growing of lean muscle mass. It improves recovery as well, just as much as, not just as much as whey protein, but it is very, very comparable to it. It costs 50p a pint. It's probably one of the best snacks you can get in a rush, I think. You know, if you're looking for protein rather than spending £2 or £3 on a protein bar, get a pint of milk instead.
Yeah, nah, spot on. That's a good answer, actually. Yeah, I'm completely with you. A couple of things off the back of that, actually. What's your opinion on, you mentioned, and this is actually really weird, it was going to come up in a minute and you'll see why, but what when we talk about red, blue or green, is there any benefit, or obviously the benefit of blue versus red is quite clear, as in red is just like water, but
flavor. Yeah.
Would you still see any benefit for someone drinking red milk? Or does it, does that
yeah,
not count?
For sure. I have a lot of red top milk as well, because it's about the fat content, and you know, mainly the main source of fat in milk is saturated fat, which you still need within your diet, but you don't want it in excess. And also, when we look at body composition based goals, it's a lot easier to get a pint of skim milk in for lower calories but still the same protein than a pint of whole milk, which will be a lot higher calories for the same protein.
Yeah.
So I think from that point of view, you know, having that grade option makes it really accessible as well as a choice, for whatever you're wanting, you know. And whole milk's been looked at for strength-based sports and its improvement on strength-based sports, milk in general and its improvement in recovery for any sport. You know, if you're looking at, if you're doing races where you're doing, you know, recovery is really, really important, you can get it obviously with, you know, flavored milk with added sugar in it to help with glycogen replenishment or the replenishment of stored carbohydrate. You know, yeah. It is a real versatile tool. And
hands down, that is the, sorry to interrupt you, but hands down, that is the best, like, post-ride, rather than beer. If you're in a situation where you can't drink beer after a ride, then that is always the second best option, like chocolate milk.
Yeah, sure. I mean, but like, that's so funny, like how it's been researched and how that's been looked at as well, and, you know, comparing them together. And milk and eggs are the, you know, score the highest on the protein digestibility rating, and protein availability. You know, they are the best proteins to have. And milk is a natural stage release protein as well. It's 80% casein, 20% whey, which means that you get fast and slow digesting proteins within that. It really is a great source of protein. And from a vegan point of view, and obviously we're talking of health and things like this, I don't know too much about the farming of milk, so I won't touch on it. But when we look at milk and its health, there's also plenty of papers out there to show it improves or reduces the risk of type 2 diabetes and obesity. It's helped with colon cancer. It helps with, you know, those two in particular. I think there was one study that looked at 60,000 people, 20,000 of which had type 2 diabetes, and they saw a reduction across the board with people that drank milk.
Yeah, that's huge. Yeah, that's a good answer. The other thing that I was going to, you briefly mentioned it yourself, the other thing that I was going to mention off the back of this, what's your opinion, if any, on this new kind of trend towards non-dairy based milk, so like almond milk and soya and things like that? Obviously the benefits the nutrition you're going to get out of that are different. Do they still have the same kind of effect in terms of what you've just said, or is it a completely different kettle of fish?
No. It's an awesome question, because I was on a vegan panel recently and I was looking at, you know, I was doing a lot of research in this, and you know, they're completely different to actual milk, you know, in every way or form. So they won't have those effects that normal milk does. But additional to that, the amount of processing that will go into creating milk like that from nut sources, and the very little literature that's out there, I haven't looked, if I'm honest, but from what I've looked at in milks and things like this and veganism, there doesn't seem to be much, if any at all. Like, nobody really knows what that does to the body. You know, like, there was that big release and talk about soya milk and its effect on estrogen levels within men and things like this, isoflavones and so on. And, you know, soya got a bit of a bad rap, and everyone's packing away, obviously, like almond milk and cashew nut milk and all this kind of stuff with very little literature on it. So you don't actually know if it's good for you.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it is bad for you, but
I see what you're saying.
We don't know.
Yeah. It struck me in the past, even past few months, how it's just that whole market has exploded. And even outside of the health or benefits or otherwise, just the amount of environmentally, the production of that amount of almond milk, for instance, is is absolutely huge. So it does seem a bit ironic when vegans jump on it and say, oh yeah, we don't want to harm the cows. And it's like that it takes a lot of energy to produce that amount of almond milk. And like you say, it's such a new product that we don't really know what's going on when we consume it.
Yeah.
All right, cool.
Yeah, I don't know much about the moral side of things, or like obviously the energy consumption to make some stuff like that. But definitely when something's not, you know, you don't know how heavily processed it is or what process it goes through, or what if it's been researched to see how good for you it is, or its effect on the body. It's an interesting one to jump to something, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. Okay, cool. Good answer. I like it. Everyone get on the milk, red, blue or green, it's up to you. Okay, so as it's nearly been an hour, I could talk for another hour. So like I said, maybe we can come back and do a few more of those. Really, really good to chat to you. But when we wrap up, we have to do a customary little quick fire round of all our guests. So the way it's going to work is I'm just going to give you a couple of choices. You just need to give me a quick answer. First thing that comes into your head, don't overthink it.
All right.
So first one, Shimano, Campag or SRAM?
SRAM.
Would you rather pull a car for 5 kilometers or ride a Boris bike with a friend on your back for 50 kilometers?
I'll pull a car.
Okay. For 5K?
Yeah.
Yeah, for cool. Sure. It's only a small car. Tea or coffee?
Tea.
What is the best cake?
Oh. Sticky toffee pudding?
That's more of a pudding. Clues in the name. But that's okay. You can have it. Milk, blue or green? I've actually wrote this question before speaking to you. That's why I thought it was quite funny. But red, blue or green? I mean, you've kind of given the answer, but pick one.
Red.
Yeah. Red. Okay. See, I like blue. But then, you know, you're a big guy. I'm a skinny little runt. That just goes to show the flexibility of the product. Like you said, crisps. What's your favorite flavor?
Prawn cocktail.
Interesting. Rogue shout. Okay, favorite pro rider?
Probably one of the ones I work with, Camille Graddick.
What's his name?
Camille Graddick.
What's so good about him?
Amazing TT rider. Okay. Incredible. Yeah.
What kind of milk does he drink?
Red.
Cool. Favorite beer?
Oh, Left Blonde.
That's nice. Yeah, good shout. Favorite Grand Tour?
Oh yeah, Tour de France.
And Marmite, do you love it or do you hate it?
Oh, I hate it.
Hate it. Okay. We could go into the nutritional benefits of Marmite, but we won't. I want to pass the final word on to you. So at the end of every episode, I just give the pulpit to our guests. If you want to leave our listeners with one thing, one final word, piece of wisdom, whatever, don't have to. You can just say bye-bye. But this is your chance. It's up to you. It doesn't have to be nutrition based. Doesn't have to be related to cycling. You can just say what you want.
I'd probably say fuel for the work required.
Okay, sensible.
Yeah, that's like my phrase that I like to use.
Yeah, I heard an analogy that I think maybe Wiggins came up with it, or maybe I just heard Wiggins reuse it. But it was just imagine when you go to the petrol station and you fill up your car, you don't squirt the petrol pump all over the car and like fill the back seats up or fill the boot with petrol. You just fill the tank up for as much as you need for that journey. And then you go on your way.
Yeah.
I don't treat my body like that. My body's not a petrol tank at the moment, but solid advice nonetheless. All right. Sweet. Thanks so much for your time, Will.
My pleasure.
Absolute blast talking to you. Best of luck with the recovery from that injury and best of luck with the PhD. Maybe when you come back for round two, you'll be a doctor. You will be the first undead doctor to feature on any given Sunday.
That would be pretty awesome.
All right, sweet. Back from the dead. That's Will Girling, ladies and gents. Take it easy, Will.
Thanks very much.
See you later.
Bye.
There it is, folks. Another one bites the dust. I hope you liked it. Really enjoyed talking to Will. And as I mentioned a couple of times in the pod, there's plenty more stuff we could go into. So stay tuned for potential part 2 at some point in the future. Until then, As I said before we started, please check out willgirling.com or on Insta at willgirling. It's G-I-R-L-I-N-G. Also, if you like that sort of thing, talking about Instagram, go and give us a follow. Any Given Sunday podcast. If you like what you're hearing, give us a like, give us a subscribe. Why not? Share the love, etc. Until next time, listeners, enjoy your riding, drink your milk, whatever colour it comes in, and whatever you do, take care of each other.